From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we chat with local health insurance navigators about insurance literacy and Wisconsin's most vulnerable people. Then author Victor Grossman defected to East Germany in 1952, and he didn't return to the U.S. until 1994. He says what surprised him the most here was the need for food banks.
East Germany, we had no such thing. There was nobody who needed food help. You couldn't get asparagus, maybe, or you couldn't get oranges and bananas and other things, too, which I miss. But you could always get enough, plenty, to feed your family.
And comedian Lewis Black talks about what makes Wisconsin politics unique.
It's the home of Joe McCarthy and Robert La Follette, okay? So how far of the political spectrum can you go from La Follette to McCarthy? You cover the whole spectrum.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, the healthcare marketplace has been an integral part of accessing health insurance for many Americans. It's a website where people can access key information about healthcare plans, like the costs of premiums and deductible limits. But for anyone unfamiliar with how health insurance works, it can be really confusing. Organizations like Covering Wisconsin are a part of a network of groups that work to help people get health care coverage. Adam Van Spankeren is the Navigator Program Manager for Covering Wisconsin, and Nick Duke is a Milwaukee-based navigator. They join Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about Wisconsin's open enrollment period, which runs from now through December 15th. Van Spankeren joins the conversation by phone, and he begins by explaining the scale of Wisconsin's uninsured population.
We still have a number of uninsured. I think we still have 53,000 children, and obviously that's really concerning in that those uninsured rates have been creeping up the past couple of years, again, despite the marketplace and efforts that have been undertaken around the state, including by Covering Wisconsin. We still see those numbers trending back up, which is a little scary.
Do we know why those numbers are trending back up?
We have some information about that for sure. We have the marketplace, obviously, the open enrollment period has shortened. And we know that enrollment during open enrollment, which used to be 3 months and is now 6 weeks, those enrollments, there were about 205,000 last year and about 225,000 the year before that, down from a high of 242,000. And in that time, the federal government has stopped advertising widely for open enrollment for healthcare.gov, the marketplace, and it's fallen on different states, including our agencies like Covering Wisconsin, to pick up that slack and to really make new inroads with communities to spread the word that the marketplace is available. The other trends we're seeing are that decreases are happening mostly amongst the low-income population, and those are people are going uninsured more often. So that is in response to premium prices have been going up, and actually more than that, misinformation around premium prices, because people think that the plans through the marketplace are unaffordable or they're not going to be eligible for Badger Care, when in fact the amount of assistance through the marketplace goes up based on how low someone's income is. So if your premium goes up, so does your assistance.
So to take a step back, you know, you mentioned that the open enrollment period has gone down by half and the budget for advertising has also gone down. What was the explanation for that?
There wasn't much of an explanation given. I will say that the open enrollment period was always supposed to be cut in half. It just wasn't supposed to happen as early as it did, and it wasn't supposed to happen without any notice, without, you know, letting people know as part of an advertising campaign. Now, I can't speak to, you know, any political insights or thoughts as to why that might have been on that stage. I can only say that that is what happened, and that choice did have an impact on the word getting out to the general public.
Yeah. And I mean, you talked about misinformation, and I will say, as somebody who at one point did go through the process of signing up through the marketplace, it's not as easy as it might sound. Covering Wisconsin, you provide a number of navigators, one of whom is in the room with me right now, Nick Duke. What is the job of a navigator? What do you do?
So navigators assist people in signing up for the health insurance through the health insurance marketplace, and we also assist people in signing up for the state BadgerCare Medicaid programs. So what we do is we schedule an appointment with a consumer. We do also have walk-in availabilities, and we just sit down and we navigate you through the application process, through the application itself. We do not recommend different plans for consumers, but we can help them understand the difference between the plans that are offered to them.
What is the purpose of going to a navigator versus doing this on your own, going to the marketplace, which I believe is accessible by a computer?
It is. So we as navigators are what people like to call enrollment experts. I don't like to refer to myself as an expert, but that's what people tend to,
but you are.
tend to call us. And so the pros of seeing a navigator are, we have done this. We know what they're looking for on the different questions. Some of the questions that are asked can be confusing, and you can make one very small misstep in filling out the application, and it can change the entire outcome.
Like what?
How your income is counted is one of the big ones, because the income is how they calculate the tax credits. So you could go from getting a significant tax credit to possibly not getting one at all, just based on a check mark that you did or didn't check throughout the application.
Wow. What are some of the misconceptions as people start to get into this process that you kind of unveil? What are some of the misconceptions they come in with?
People come in thinking, you know, first and foremost, that health insurance is too expensive. I think that's probably the biggest one, and that's one that stops them from coming in the door or even trying to approach the process of enrolling in plans for the next year. And that honestly is biggest hurdle. And then when they come in, we educate around what some of these insurance terms mean and how insurance works, because a lot of the misconceptions, they exist on a personalized basis because everyone's experience with insurance is a little bit different. And, you know, there's no class on how insurance works in high school. We've done a few presentations at the high school level, but in general, there's no class on how insurance works. So when people become adults and need to figure it out on their own, they really haven't ever had it explained to them or resources put in their hands where they can figure things out. So there might be misconceptions around what a deductible is or how that works or why they're getting doctor bills when they have insurance and things like that, so that they come to us and we try to dispel this confusion at all steps in the process.
So what are some of the stumbling blocks that people come across? I mean, you just mentioned one, not checking something that could have a huge impact on how much you're paying. What are some of the other stumbling blocks that people come across when they're doing this on their own?
A lot of people, it's just health insurance literacy and knowledge. We do a lot of education. Things from just defining what some of the different terms mean. There's a lot of jargon in health insurance, and a lot of people just have never had to learn the definitions before. So we do a lot of that. That can cause people a lot of confusion.
There was something that for me became very confusing as I was picking out plans, even through my work, the deductible versus the out-of-pocket expense, just what these two things mean.
Sure. So a deductible is generally the amount of money you have to pay out of pocket in addition to your monthly premium before certain benefits kick in or can be applied. And then an out-of-pocket or an out-of-pocket maximum, that's the maximum amount of money you will pay in addition to your premium throughout the entire year.
So when I first heard deductible, I had assumed that that's what deductible meant. What are the different terms that people go, I don't understand, but have a huge impact on their plan?
So deductible and out-of-pocket maximum are two of the biggest ones. Premium, just explaining what a premium is.
Coinsurance is a big one. Yeah.
Coinsurance, explain that.
Sure. So coinsurance is the percentage, and that's what, honestly, percentages are hard for people to grasp and hard to picture in terms of dollars, certainly. But basically, after you've hit your deductible, how much in percentage of your bills and services is the health plan covering? So you might see coinsurance of, you know, 20%, where you pay 20% and the insurance picks up 80, you know, with a plan through the marketplace. And that number, that percentage, can change based on what level of plan you've picked.
Yeah. You know, this is something that your organization has been doing for a long time, and I know you have repeat customers. As people come back year after year, does it seem like they're becoming acclimated to this jargon, this kind of almost language that is used inside of insurance?
I would say, in general, our repeat consumers do seem to have a better grasp on some of the terminology. Some of the questions that I get for repeat consumers are more in-depth on how to use their insurance, or they know that they have this particular procedure that they need to schedule this year, and they want to try to figure out more closely how much that will cost them specifically. Things like that, where the first-time consumers, it really is a lot of education, just defining the terms and getting to understand what it all looks like.
When we're talking about first-time consumers right now, what are the big demographics of people who you're trying to reach?
There's a lot of what we would call vulnerable populations, and it starts right away with income. So anyone who is, you know, below 250% of the federal poverty level, and oftentimes they'll be eligible for Badger Care, and we'll obviously help with that as well. But really, people who aren't making a lot of money and whose jobs aren't offering them insurance, that's number one. Then we see a lot of that's happening in communities of color. So we're making sure we're reaching out to the Latinx population and African American communities. But then there are specifically, there's immigrant populations where there is just a dearth of information that isn't reaching those families, where they know that they're not eligible for Badger Care, for example, because they haven't been here long enough. But they're not finding out necessarily that they need to enroll in the marketplace, that they have that option. And they might miss open enrollment, so we really try to spread the word about that. And then we work with community partners to reach all the populations we possibly can, including faith-based, where we're trying to get information into schools. And then, Nick, any other specific populations in the Milwaukee area you're working on?
The young adult population, or what we like to refer to as young invincible population, those individuals who may be aging off of their parents' insurance, but not quite having an employer that's offering them coverage.
Is that a large group of the uninsured people in Milwaukee?
That is one of the target populations that we work with. We do events with the universities in the area to try to make ourselves available to those students and other individuals in that age range.
When you're signing people up for healthcare plans, are there any major obstacles that you come across a lot?
When you say obstacles, the lack of information is the main one that we've been talking about and around.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, that's a big part of it. But there's more specific ones with misinformation that, for example, if somebody's offered employer-sponsored coverage, then they don't know whether they're supposed to take that, or they didn't know they were supposed to take that. So they come during open enrollment for the marketplace having missed that open enrollment period, and then we have to have a difficult conversation. Or there's something called the family glitch related to family coverage and the marketplace. So we get pretty deep in the weeds when we start talking about obstacles. But truth be told, when we're signing people up, there aren't that many obstacles stopping us from getting people insurance. The plans are there. The options are there. We know how to do the applications. Nick said we are referred to as experts because we've been doing this a long time. And honestly, it's just a matter of getting the word spread out there that people know that the plans are available and that there's help to sign up.
What's changed this year for people who are entering the healthcare marketplace?
Sure. We're obviously we're only 6 days in right now, so we're spreading the word and we're still tracking new trends in the different populations throughout the state where we're working and with our subcontracts. So we don't have all of the data on what has totally changed yet. It looks like plan prices might be up a little bit, but I don't think that's actually true because the plan prices have gone down on average by about 4.2% for this coming year, and in some cases a lot more than that. So what we're seeing might be actually that the tax credits, the savings that people are getting, might be going down by a little bit because of the way the prices are set, but also it could just be, as Nick was saying, the way people are reporting their income information. We know that people who are returning to the marketplace really need to double check and make sure that their information is right, to make sure they're getting the correct price, because when a health plan reaches out to you in the middle of the year and says you're going to need to renew for next year, they don't have the right information. They don't know what's going to happen in 2020 and how your household has changed. So it's really important that consumers make those adjustments. In the Madison area, we're not seeing too many changes to the plans here. There are still three plans available in this area. Companies, when I say plans, that's companies, each of which has many different health insurance plans available. And the prices and copays and things like that are looking very similar to what we saw last year. Nick, what are you seeing there in Milwaukee?
So we still have four companies available in the Milwaukee area. And the same thing, we're not seeing a whole lot of changes. Some slight increases in plan premiums, but then again, the tax credits increase as well. So far in the first few days of open enrollment, not a whole lot of changes for people signing up this year for 2020 coverage.
So far, pretty calm. All right. Well, Adam, Nick, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Absolutely. Thank you for helping us spread the word. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Adam Van Spankeren is the Navigator Program Manager for Covering Wisconsin. He joined us by phone. Nick Duke is a Milwaukee-based navigator for the organization. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about Wisconsin's open enrollment period, which runs now through December 15th. There's also a link to more information at WUWM.com. Coming up next, on the eve of the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, we'll talk with an American who defected to East Germany in 1952 and has lived there ever since. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. In 1952, Victor Grossman defected to the Soviet Union. He was born Stephen Wexler in New York City, and Grossman says defecting wasn't something that he wanted to do. But he was afraid that the U.S. Army would find out about his socialist and communist activities while he was a student at Harvard University. This was a time when anti-communist sentiment ran very high in the United States, and Grossman knew he was looking at the possibility of decades of jail time. So Grossman swam the Danube one night to turn himself in to the Soviets. He changed his name to protect his family members in the U.S., and he was sent to East Germany to study journalism. It's an occupation he still pursues today at the age of 91. In 1994, Grossman was pardoned and was allowed to return to the U.S. to visit family, but he still makes his home in Berlin, and he reports on the political climate in his adopted home. Grossman is also the author of a number of books, the latest of which is a memoir called A Socialist Defector from Harvard to Karl Marx Allee. He was in Milwaukee on a book tour earlier this year, and he stopped by the studio to tell us about his remarkable life. He says while the government of the German Democratic Republic, or GDR, did many reprehensible things, it also did a lot of good things as well, like strongly opposing apartheid in South Africa.
This is one of the things which made me remain devoted to the GDR, in spite of all the things which were I didn't like, and there were plenty. There were four or five factors that made me stay quite faithful. And one of them was they supported Allende in Chile and not the fascist dictator Pinochet. They supported the South African freedom movement of Mandela and not the apartheid, always in contradiction to West Germany, which always was on the other side. They also supported North Vietnam and not the war against Vietnam. They supported in Algeria, freedom for Algeria. This, to me, was very important. They supported people in the United States. Of course, there was a political angle to it, but it meant supporting people who were imprisoned because of race or probably because of race. There was a feeling of solidarity with poor people around the world, which meant a lot to me because I was raised in that principle. However, as you point out, that money question was very, very decisive because they had to have Western money to buy basic resources, which were very, very rare. The GDR had almost no – Eastern Germany had almost nothing except bad quality coal. That's all it had. So it had to buy cotton. It had to buy iron. It had to buy all kinds of minerals that it didn't have. And this meant exporting to get that Western money. And this meant that they could never get as many of the commodities, such as oranges and bananas or fashionable shoes. Never, they tried to keep some coming, but they could never meet demand in any way. And this, of course, made people very dissatisfied. At the same time, I should point out that in spite of the problems in this sense, there were some advantages which also were very important to me. The fact that if you paid a certain tax taken out of your salary or your wages, all medical and dental expenses completely were covered, from a delivery of birth at birth, child care, nursery, dental care, glasses, hearing aids. Also, as in my case, when I was very ill for 9 weeks with hepatitis, after 9 weeks paying nothing, I was sent twice to four-week spas where to recuperate. And everything was covered, all treatments from bubble baths and mud baths and everything, and all transportation. And I got 90% of my wages. This and also such things as education. Myself and both my sons went to college not only free, but got enough money to cover basic expenses. This meant also, I should mention perhaps, that housing rent was extremely cheap. The level of 1945 was maintained until 1990 without ever changing, which was not so good economically perhaps, but it was very good for the people who had to pay it. And not only that, if you didn't, you couldn't be thrown out of your apartment. Evictions were forbidden. That is forbidden usually for a long time, warning and warning. If you still didn't pay, they could put you out, but only if they gave you another cheaper apartment to live in. So nobody was sleeping in the streets, no beggars. These things meant a lot to me because I was raised in a feeling for people who are down and out, for the underdog, for people who are having trouble. I had experienced only 2 weeks of unemployment in the United States, but they demeaned me. I felt just 2 weeks made me feel as if I were sort of crawling when I went to a personal office asking if they have jobs. In the GDR, nobody had that fear because they were always, you could not be fired. Nobody was out of work, maybe for weeks or so, but nobody was out of work, which meant, of course, that in the factories, without fear of work, there was a more relaxed atmosphere, which often meant not quite so much productivity. People would go to the dentist on work time or to the doctor or even go shopping. If the factory shop had fresh cherries or strawberries or something which is hard to get like oranges, they'd send a couple of men from the work team there if it was possible, so that there was a more relaxed atmosphere, which meant less produced but perhaps less pressure.
What do you think the East Germans lost in unification?
First of all, they gained the possibility of travel anywhere in the world. They gained the possibility of buying any commodity they wanted and it could afford. They gained the lack of the one-sided propaganda. Propaganda there is always in every country, but this one-sided propaganda. They gained, since I'm mentioning that, in television in GDR, there were no commercials, which in a way was a pleasant. I liked that. On radio too, no commercials, and much less advertising in general, very little advertising. They lost a sense of security. There is still, especially in East Germany, a feeling of what's going to happen tomorrow. Will my job still be going tomorrow? Are they going to close the factory the day after tomorrow, which they do? What happened is the young people left looking for jobs in the West or in other countries, and old people are left, and especially young men. The girls who are free and able to take care of themselves without mother, they tended to go move out. The young men who were perhaps couldn't get along so well without a mother, they tended to stay without much hope, and they are open prey to the fascists, who moved in very quickly after unification. They moved in from the West or they came out of the woodwork in the East, because in the East, any Nazi ideas, including anti-Semitism, for example, or racism, were absolutely forbidden. It doesn't mean that they disappeared. It meant that people who still had such ideas kept their mouth shut or confined them to their family or close friends. Publicly, you never heard any anti-Semitic or racist remarks or jokes or anything else. Never. And I, being Jewish, was especially sensitive to this and on the lookout. but almost never. I think I could count the cases where I ran into it about on one hand. But after reunification, these people came out, and now they're getting stronger and stronger.
It's kind of terrifying what's happening in Germany now with the populist movements and the AfD and all of that. This groundswell, and they're winning seats in parliament, and they're, you know, it's like, what is going on?
Yes, they've won 94 seats in the National Bundestag, parliament. And not only that, in September, there will be elections in 3 of the 5 East German states. In 2 of them, it looks like they may be the strongest party. This is frightening. And frightening, too, right near my house, I think not 200 yards from my house, about a year ago, I saw a whole marsh of real Nazis. They didn't have swastikas, but you could just see by the looks and by their signs that they were not allowed to carry swastikas. That's forbidden, or open Nazi. But it was so clear what they were, and they were making demands of Nazis and celebrating the Nazis, just a slightly veiled language. Marching by, I should add that there are plenty of young people especially who oppose them, and the police try to keep them apart, but sometimes tend to shade more towards these orderly Nazis as to the often hippie-looking anti-fascists. It is a frightening situation today, really, especially in East Germany.
It seems to me that when unification happened, that what really happened is the East Germans were sort of absorbed into the West. There wasn't really an equal exchange. Is that fair?
What happened was that, first of all public industry, which was virtually all except very small, a tiny little company, was all previously state-owned, which meant that nobody made profits on it, of course. This went back into the state for various reasons. This was suddenly changed. Several millions were thrown out of work. But not only that, the universities, almost all professors were thrown out, and also the other teaching personnel. Some in the natural sciences were kept, but not even them. I have a friend who is a research scientist, a very good one. She was pushed out of her job. The universities were cleansed of Easterners. By the way, there's a nickname. The West Germans were called Wessies. The East Germans, from the German word for East is Ost. We were the Ossies. And the Ossies were thrown out of all administration jobs, higher level. They were thrown out of the newspapers, out of the television, out of radio, out of teaching. In all these fields, they were replaced by Wessies, who were often second string or third string people who hadn't quite made it in the West, who came over to the East, got these cushy jobs, got a bonus for coming to the East, and of course created a terrific feeling of antagonism, Ossies and Wessies, which still, even after 30 years, has not disappeared, especially since wages are still about 5 to 10% lower in the East than the West. Mm-hmm. Unemployment is 5 to 10% higher. Pensions are generally lower. This is gradually being improved, but it's still there. So there's a huge amount of resentment of the Ossies against the Wessies. Even in East-West Berlin, which was divided, there are still many people in East Berlin who never go over to West Berlin, and West Berlins who never go to East Berlin, especially older people. Younger people tend to cross. There is no border, except there's a line they've marked, but otherwise there's nothing. But there are still these resentment is there.
What do you think is going to happen on the 30th anniversary? How do you think people are going to react to that?
Well, there's going to be an awful lot of hullabaloo every such anniversary, and there are lots of them. Every 5 years is an anniversary of unification. Every 5 years is an anniversary when the wall went down. And that means almost every year. And that means weeks in advance, television starts building up the celebrations. And this one, of course, 30th, will be especially big. I would say that a certain portion of the East Germans are doing better now with more modern and more or less satisfied, although even they are hit by what's called burn, you know, by having to work harder, tougher, especially later hours, and not being able to answer back. The pressure is very strong, and this has had a strong psychological effect on people. But about a third, in terms of living standards, are doing better. About a third are more or less the same, more commodities but less of something else. And about a third are doing badly and worse. Worst hit, single parents are hit very badly. Many categories of elder people whose pensions are very low. many categories of children who are, if they come from poorer families, they say there are 3 million under the poverty line in Germany. They will be sour about all this. And not only that, people like me, when we are told almost every evening in television, but especially at anniversaries, we're told how terrible we had it in the East. Oh, how you poor people and how wonderful it is now. And people know that they didn't live terribly. There were always shortages. There's always something to get angry about. But where isn't there in life? Most people live very normal lives. So a lot of people will be sarcastic or cynical about how wonderful it is now and compared to then. Others will rejoice. It depends on how you made it in life.
Yeah. It's an interesting time. And it's an interesting thing to see how people from different parts of Germany negotiate all of that. You know, there are so many Westerners that I know who sort of look down on those from the East still.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that they hate most, to be looked down. These people came in as administrators over everything from traffic to sewage, and they acted as if they were the only ones who knew how to do things right, taking over from people who had been working on this for 10, 20, 30 years. But we know, I know many such cases where they were meeting the person who came in had a higher wage, was above their heads, although they knew more about it. This meant for really bitterness in the part of many, many. Add to this that Germany is in the middle of Europe, and although people are also worried about the fact that there's more and more talk of war, there are big maneuvers going on the Russian border. And that's not so far from Germany as it is from the United States, though Poland is in between. Nevertheless, any spark, maybe a mistake, could set off basically an atomic war if it works wrongly. And people in general in Germany, East and West, perhaps more East than West, would prefer to have a more or less normal relationship with Russia. Regardless of what they think of Putin or anybody, they prefer to have a peaceful, normal relationship where they can sell their cars and sell their fruit and vegetables and maybe visit sometime, although it's not much of a tourist attraction, but it is. Some people go and like to see the Kremlin, etc. But they would prefer that to this seemingly mounting fear, hatred really, or up from the border up in the north, Estonia, Ukraine, Syria, the Black Sea and other areas. It worries a lot of people. And the political parties are taking different stands on this, but it's worrisome. And people are looking for answers in that too, I think.
Yes, which is, I think, why some people look to the rigidity of fascism and look to the populist movements, because it seemingly offers those answers, but they don't.
It's true. In many cases, people say the fall of the blame for my uncertainty in my job, and especially that of my children, or if something happens, the uncertainty, the establishment up above is to blame. And who's the establishment? That's the ruling parties today, the important who've ruled since 1945, 49. And therefore, they choose anything but, which means either the Green Party, which is not like the Green Party here, it's not a left-wing party, or the fascists, or the left-wing party, though not too many. The fascist party is now at about 13%, but in the East much higher, 20, 25, 26. The two major parties, which have always ruled the roost, they've been going down, down, down. And so it's very open what happens in Germany. And since Germany is the most strongest party in Europe and is trying to build up an army, a European army, which it would dominate, this leads to possible dangers in the whole situation, which are worrisome, which few Americans know about or think about. But a lot of Germans don't think about it either. They're worried about making ends meet, getting job, etc. But a lot of people, too, are worried about what the future could bring.
I think it was 1994, you were allowed back in the U.S. What does it look like when you come back to visit now? I mean, you're here on this book tour. You're visiting Milwaukee, which is a very German city, has a very, a lot of German history. What do you see compared to the United States you left in 1952?
First of all, I should mention that early attempts to return, which I always wanted to do, were either either I doubted that I could get by without severe punishment or uncertainty. In 1994, it became possible to return and be excused. I was discharged from the U.S. Army after 42 years and with no punishment. I was very grateful for that, I must say, especially since the law was unconstitutional in the meantime. But it was not so surprising to me what I found, because I had kept up with things through television, through radio, especially the Armed Forces Network. I could hear every hour the same news that people heard in the United States, and of course letters and correspondence, etc., so that it was not so new. Some things were very new to me. For example, unlike the past, African Americans played a much, much more important part in the economy in every field, and I saw many, many cases of people mixing, black, white, Asian, which had not been the case when I left. But I also saw what was painful, the many, many, many people sleeping in the streets. It's now in Berlin, too, but not so much as I have seen in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. In Milwaukee, I haven't seen it as yet. I don't know if it's just...
It's here.
But I've learned, for example, about Milwaukee. In writing this book, I found out there's a book about Milwaukee telling that 16,000 evictions in 1 year. This was, as I said before, we had no evictions. It was outlawed. These things pained me because it's my country. And it pained me to read of people going to these so-called pantries to get food, a food aid, which in the meantime is also in Germany, East and West. East Germany, we had no such thing. There was nobody who needed food help. You couldn't get asparagus, maybe, or you couldn't get oranges or bananas and other things too, which I miss. But you could always get enough, plenty, to feed your family. This I wrote about in my book as well, how this pained me, because, as I say, it's my country where I grew up in. And I think if you take all the money that they're storing in Cayman Islands or in Liechtenstein or Austria—
Or Switzerland.
Switzerland. If you take that and put it to the benefit of the people, which they tried to do with problems and blunders and mistakes, but basically trying to do, I think it would be a good thing to learn.
Do you find when you come here to talk— particularly with the book, that people push back, that they have this idea of the GDR of being unremittingly gray and bad, that they're not willing to hear what you have to say about it?
Well, no, because most of my audiences have been people who are more or less open to such ideas, if not sympathetic to them. Otherwise, they wouldn't be quite so likely to come to my meetings. To my book. But of course I've met up with this in speaking with many people, less so at my book readings. But in general, of course, I've met with people who, it seems to me, and watching television as well, I think television and other news, social media too, fail to make people realize what is happening in the rest of the world, both the good and the bad. Looking inward all the time, I think it's necessary to see that in Sudan, the poor people are fighting against a military dictatorship. I see this hardly mentioned in the media today. I've always been interested in all countries since I was – that's part of the reason I became a leftist, because I was interested in what's happening in Peru or in Afghanistan or in Cambodia, always close to my heart. I think it would do good for people to – think of these people not as strange people who don't even know how to talk English, but as friends, as brothers and sisters. It's something in many religions this is embodied, but not only in religions, to see them as who are also trying to work to find a better life. And the United States, I think, should therefore, if people would take more interest, do more to cause better lives than throwing bombs and drones. I would hope so much that people work towards changing it and having the United States and Germany, both two of the richest countries in the world, spend their money not on bombs and missiles, but on closing in with these people, helping them to move ahead, also their own people, but helping people to improve their lives, whether it's in deserts where they don't have water or fighting diseases in these poor countries. This would be so much more worthwhile. That is part of the reason why I wrote this book, to try and explain these things as well as the way I can see them, and hope that people, even if they don't agree with me, might think a little about it and perhaps argue with me about it if they'd like.
Victor Grossman, thank you so much for making Lake Effect a stop on your book tour. I appreciate it.
And thank you very much for inviting me.
Victor Grossman is an author and journalist who lives in Berlin. His newest book is a memoir called A Socialist Defector, From Harvard to Karl Marx Allee. He was in Milwaukee earlier this year on a book tour, and we spoke with him then. The 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall is this Saturday, November 9th. The citywide celebrations have already begun. From one socialist to another, we'll take a short break and then speak with comedian Louis Black, who joins us with his best Milwaukee drinking stories. That comes your way when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. If you're familiar with comedian Louis Black's work, you might think that Wisconsin's swing state status makes it a dangerous place to perform. The self-described socialist is also an avid political commentator and the ACLU's voting rights ambassador. But it's not the politics that make performing in Wisconsin hazardous to Black's health. It's the drinking. Louis Black will be back in the city tomorrow and Saturday for his The Jokes on Us tour at the Pabst Theater. But first, he spoke with Lake Effect's Troy Powers by phone and started by describing his worst or possibly best story about drinking in Milwaukee.
I, one night, had been out drinking with the group, and I finally thought that I'd pace myself, because I thought I could drink pretty well, until I got to Wisconsin. And I was going back, and I realized I just couldn't run with the bulls. I came in once, and I'd been drinking, and then we were on Water Street at a bar there. And then they closed the bar, and I went, this is great. I did it. I'm feeling good. I drank, and I hung in there, and I did as well as possible. I'm really proud of myself. And then they said, we're closing the doors now, and now we're going to go upstairs and really drink. And I realized, wow, I'm just not a professional.
It's surprising. I remember going, I'm from Wisconsin originally. I remember going off to college in Illinois, not that far away. And I went, I thought like people really drank in college.
Yeah.
It's so easy here. And then I went home and I went, no, Wisconsin has a problem.
I don't know if it's a problem. It's just they just seem to have adjusted to it. There just seems to be a level at which they know how to function. I mean, a Friday night late show in any comedy club in the country, people are crazy. You know, they come off of work, they had dinner, they've had drinks, they're all excited, and they're way too drunk for the late show. In Wisconsin, they literally are just getting started. Nothing is phasing them. I mean, I've never heard people, I can't believe you went from vodka to brandy to beer to wine. What is with it? Why would you guys switch drinks? And the person said, because we don't want to lose our taste for any alcohol. I thought, wow, it's really remarkable.
Yeah, the best is when people will have a shot and then they'll chase it with more alcohol. And you go, well, why would you chase it with it then?
Yeah, nobody else gives you a Bloody Mary and a beer. Nobody.
So, you know, you're coming back to Wisconsin. You've been here a number of times with a number of different shows. How does this new tour compare to what you've done previously?
Well, I mean, it's a totally different show than the show I did last time. It's about, the last 2 years as opposed to the 2 years before that. I mean, when I return to a city, I don't do the show that I did before. Basically, I'm talking about the last 2 years. So I'm telling the story of what I've seen over the last 2 years from my point of view. And I don't dwell on what people consider to be the politics of the moment, because I think it's always deeper than that. It's mostly about what's going on. And I mean, what's going on deeper than what we're seeing, you know, how this stuff is affecting us as opposed to, you know, what it is that gets us excited, you know, and just the fact that we've literally have found a whole other way to not get anything done. I mean, we show a creativity when it comes to not accomplishing things like nobody's business. Now we've discovered that both parties live in different realities. totally different realities. We've never been there. But I don't sit and dwell on that. I talk about what it means in part and come up with stories about it. I talk about it in other ways. I think I know what's wrong with America. I think I've discovered what's wrong with it. I found it accidentally while driving on a highway between Buffalo and Jamestown, New York. And I tell that story. And what it describes in many ways is just how really stupid we are as a people. But I also think it nails on the head who and what we are and what the problem is in terms of the country. And it's not what anybody thinks. It's not because of him, and it's not because of the Democrats, and it's not because of the Republicans, and it's something much deeper and much funnier.
You know, it brings to mind the fact that, of course, you're coming to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is kind of a Democratic stronghold, but Wisconsin itself is a very divided state politically. Each of our elections, they're pretty close. What kind of audiences here, how do they respond to your brand of humor?
They've been great. They're always great. They always get it. Because they're there to have fun, no matter what side they're on. You know, and I can yell at them. I can yell at them when they, if they didn't like the last governor, I can yell at them about that. That's what I did last time. You know, I'll say, oh, you know, you guys elected him. And they just start yelling, oh, and I go, well, you know, yes, you did. I mean, come on. You know, and I find in a way what's really interesting about all of it is, you know, it really goes down to this. It's the home of Joe McCarthy and Robert La Follette, okay? So how far of the political spectrum can you go from La Follette to McCarthy?
Yeah.
And you cover the whole spectrum.
Something I read about you is you consider yourself a socialist. And since the 2016 election, there have been people inside of the Democratic Party pushing more and more toward concepts that are associated with socialism. But many have also rebuked that term. As a self-described socialist, how do you view that?
I think, first off, to fear socialism in this country is psychotic. Well, socialism is, in a sense, at this point in time, and has been for a long, long time, is a way to just kind of go, hey, we have to take care of people. I know you don't want to, but we kind of have to. That's what we're really good at. It's why we're here. I think it's really that's what's important about it. You know, and to act as if that the Democratic Party is socialist is appalling. Just appalling. Really? They're just as capitalistic as the rest of you, as all of the Republicans, please. They used to say the president was a socialist. I said, no, he's not a socialist. There are 8 socialists in the country, and we call him every Sunday afternoon to see if he'll be able to play on our baseball team, and he won't.
Another issue, an issue that you've been very vocal about, is voting rights. You're actually an ambassador for voting rights for the ACLU. What makes you passionate about this issue?
Well, what makes me passionate is because it's one would think that a country in which the right to vote is really important and voting is important and it's the cornerstone of democracy is the ability for somebody to walk in and to choose someone that they want to be their leader. And then you're going to find ways to inhibit that. What is the matter with you? You don't get to do that. You don't get to do it through gerrymandering. You don't get to take away power of somebody's voice. You just don't get to do it. You don't get to gerrymander, and you don't get to make people go through hoops to vote. You should do everything that's humanly possible to make it as easy as possible for them to get to a voting booth, as it is only 60% of us vote. And you're going to try to prevent people from voting? And that's on a good day, 60% of us vote. It's ridiculous.
Gerrymandering is one thing that we've faced specifically here in Wisconsin. Of course, the case in Wisconsin went to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
You know, we faced a number of issues, gerrymandering, voter ID laws, different kinds of obstacles to getting to the voter booth. What would you see change to make voting easier in the United States as a whole, but, you know, in Wisconsin?
Well, I mean, you first off, you don't allow anyone who's an elected official to decide how the state is divided up in terms of voting districts. They don't get to do that. The person who's elected doesn't get to decide, you know, how people get to vote and where they get to vote. No. You were elected. That's what you got. You get an independent commission that comes in. And if you can't figure out how to get an independent commission, then you get every child in elementary school a map of Wisconsin. And you have them divided up into how many districts there are in Wisconsin. And and let them divide it up however they want. And you put all those maps together and send them through a computer, and however the kids decided to draw it up, that's the way, whatever the consensus is, that's the map of Wisconsin.
You know, a lot of people are telling us here in Wisconsin, you know, you're the state to watch in the next election. You're the state that's going to make the big decisions. And of course, the DNC is going to be here. But you're somebody who's been to the state a number of times, who's performed and talked to people about politics. Do you have hope for the future of politics in light of sort of Wisconsin's involvement in it? How do you see that going?
The instinct of the American people is quite simply what you see. If there's a catastrophe somewhere in the country, whole groups of people jump in their cars who don't know the people where the catastrophe is taking place and drive there to help them. That's American people, as far as I can see, their basic instinct. I've spent time with the military, a lot of time, on USO tours. The way in which they treat each other and act toward each other and take care of each other, that gives me hope. What we are watching, the pendulum swings and it goes back and forth. And you can only go so far with what's occurring now. The big thing is always, gee, I really like this president because he talks like me. Well, that's why you're not the president. This only goes so far. A lot of people like myself, and I think we're a majority, just in terms, not as policies, I don't care. You don't get to speak like that. You're the president. I'm sorry. There have to be adults in the room. And I believe that adults will come forward because of this and realize, you know, they call it Washington insiders. They call it whatever they want. I call it, you need adults. There are people who step forward and don't talk about policy or whatever it is. No, make it political. You don't get to call people human scum. You don't get to say, I'm going to shoot somebody on that street on Fifth Avenue and nobody to arrest me. You just don't. I don't care if you're the president. Children are listening. That's what's important. And will that be allowed to go on much more? I don't think so. Because I think the next group of people who are in charge on whatever side will realize that children are listening. And also will realize that when they say something, it has a lot of power.
Well, Lewis Black, we're looking forward to having you here in Wisconsin. And thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Well, tell me, and also the folks should know that I'll be a lot funnier when I get there. It's too early in the day for me to be humorous.
No worries.
Lewis Black is a stand-up comedian, actor, and social activist. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Black will be in Milwaukee this Friday and Saturday for his The Jokes on Us tour at the Pabst Theater. You can find more information at WUWM.com. And that's all we have for today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect every week with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Mayan Silver, Angelina Mosher-Salazar, and Taryn Powell this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. And Willie Porter wrote our theme music. And we also welcome our new executive producer, Becky Mortensen, this week. Welcome, Becky. It is great to have you on board. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.